the crisis is being handled
poorly.
It's a life. It's got a life.
What?
And we're putting out that life because that's a bad life that we're talking about.
Do you know what he's talking about?
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight. I got the feeling that something ain't right. I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Yes, from Pacifica Radio, this is The Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles. Elsewhere in California on KFOI, Red Bluff, Redding, KKRN, Round Mountain, KGOE, Eureka. In Oregon on KYAQ on the Central Coast, KSO, Cottage Grove, KEPW in Eugene. In Lancaster, Pennsylvania, WLRI, Maui, Hawaii, KAKU, Columbus, Ohio, WGRN, in Palenville, New York, WLPP, Grand Rapids, Michigan, WPRR, New Orleans, Louisiana, WHIV, in Gallup, New Mexico, KNIZ, Concord, New Hampshire, WNHN, Fayetteville, Arkansas, KPSQ, Seattle, Washington, KODX, Janesville, Wisconsin, WADR, Minneapolis, St. Paul, AM 950, KTNF, and coast to coast and around the globe, streaming on the internets, on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Radio for Humans, FYI Nation, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, Workforce Rising, Deprogrammed Radio, and Detour Talk. Blanketing the globe 5 days a week, usually hosted by Brad Friedman of bradblog.com, but he and Desi are taking a few days off for the July 4th holiday, so you got me again. I'm Nicole Sandler. I host The Nicole Sandler Show. It's based at NicoleSandler.com. Heard on the Progressive Voices Network and stations like these around the world, too, I suppose. And always available as a podcast from NicoleSandler.com. And happy to be here. There's, as usual, just so much going on. We can barely scratch the surface in an hour, so we'll do our best to bring you a little bit of everything. Coming up today, our interview is with Congressman Eric Swalwell of California's 15th District, I believe. He's got a brand new book out called Endgame, Inside the Impeachment of Donald J. Trump. And what else do you want to talk about over the 4th of July than the impeachment of Donald Trump? But we've got news and a few other tidbits to share with you. But I like to start my show each day with something funny because over the course of the hour, things get so serious. So today I thought I would share with you one of the funnies that I found for my program this week. And well, this one is courtesy of a website called The Recount. I don't know a whole lot about them. It's at therecount.com. And just know whoever edited this together edited the video. So I will post a link to it from bradblog.com where today's show is posted so you can watch it because this took a lot of patience on somebody's part. But basically, these are the words that we would like to hear from Donald Trump because he owes America an apology.
Ladies and gentlemen, today I'm announcing I'm sorry for the way I handled the whole coronavirus pandemic right now. I'm doing a very, very terrible job. Thousands of people are dying and dying, violently dying. It's kind of my fault. Can you believe the fake news is still showing my briefings in these briefings? Well, I think I've been incredibly racist toward the Asian Americans. We have to protect our Asian Americans from me. I suggested medical treatments like hydroxychloroquine. And a disinfectant, even though I'm not a doctor. I'm not a doctor. Please listen to Dr. Fauci, Dr. Birx. Again, I'm not a doctor. I have blamed a lot of people. And I'm not just blaming President Obama. I blame the governors, the World Health Organization, and China for my big failure. That was a tremendous failure with regard to the virus. I can say very honestly, I'm just a third-rate president. I am, I will tell you, a tremendous danger to our country. But don't worry about it. In a few months, you can vote. One day, my presidency
will go away. You know it. You know it is going away.
I said this virus will go away fast, and it hasn't. So please thank our healthcare workers. And remember this: ultraviolet or just very powerful light is not a cure. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Oh yeah, that deserves a round of applause. TheRecount.com. Again, I will post the video at bradblog.com along with today's show. So I guess with that, we should get to the news. The news is not quite so funny.
I read the news today, oh boy.
The United States confirmed over 55,000 new coronavirus cases on Thursday, hitting another single-day record. More than 10,000 of those cases were in Florida, where Governor Ron DeSantis is in denial and is reluctant to take any definitive measures. In Texas, though, Governor Greg Abbott, who just a few weeks ago prohibited mayors throughout the state from making mandatory mask orders, has changed course, now issuing a statewide order requiring people in counties with more than 20 diagnosed cases to wear face coverings inside businesses or other buildings open to the public or in outdoor public space where social distancing is impossible. COVID cases are now on the rise in 40 states. Many of them have now rolled back reopening plans. North Carolina Governor Roy Cooper, who issued a statewide mask order last week, vetoed a bill calling for letting gyms and amusement parks reopen. Well, Donald Trump begins his three-day Independence Day weekend at Mount Rushmore, where 7,500 people are expected to attend a fireworks display on Friday night. Republican Governor Kristi Noem, a Trump ally, said masks will be optional and social distancing won't be required at the event. That prompted objections from local officials, including the Republican mayor of nearby Rapid City. Leaders of several Native American tribes in the region also warned the event could result in a coronavirus spike among their members. You think? Harold Frazier, chairman of the Cheyenne River Sioux tribe, said, "The president is putting our tribal members at risk to stage a photo op at one of our most sacred sites." Authorities are watching trends around Tulsa, Oklahoma, following Trump's rally there last week. And there are some troubling signs. For instance, former Republican presidential candidate Herman Cain is in the hospital. Cain learned Monday that he had tested positive for COVID-19 and was admitted on Wednesday. Yes, he attended Trump's June 20th rally in Tulsa. Now, the Trump campaign announced hours before the event that six staff members on the advance team had tested positive for the coronavirus. And after the rally, two members of the Secret Service who attended also tested positive. Cain said in a video on his website that he had worn a mask at the event when in groups of people, but he posted photos on social media showing him without a mask, surrounded by a lot of other unmasked people. The Supreme Court on Thursday agreed to hear the Trump administration's appeal of a lower court ruling that said Congress should have access to secret grand jury materials from then special counsel Robert Mueller's Russia investigation. So, the Supreme Court will take up the case in its next term that starts in October, which means that Democrats won't get to see the secret grand jury testimony before the November presidential election. An appeals court previously sided with Democrats and said that lawmakers should be given access to the materials because Mueller's probe stopped short of coming to a conclusion about whether the president tried to obstruct justice. The DOJ says the House hasn't indicated that it, quote, urgently needs these materials for any ongoing impeachment investigation. Maybe it's time to start a new one. As for the remaining eight Supreme Court decisions still to be announced, the court said they would begin releasing the next batch Monday morning at 10 a.m. Eastern. Well, you know the old adage, money talks? Well, as monuments to Confederate traitors continue to fall and the outrage over such tributes are being reconsidered, new pressure from investors has prompted FedEx to ask the Washington NFL franchise, still inexplicably known as the Redskins, to change its name. FedEx paid $205 million for the naming rights to Washington Stadium in 1999, so the team plays on FedEx Field. Adweek reported Wednesday that a group of 87 investment firms had written three letters to Nike, FedEx, and PepsiCo, asking the companies to sever their business ties with the Washington team unless they dropped the current moniker. By the way, Frederick Smith is the founder of FedEx and the company's CEO, and he's also a member of the team's ownership group. Yes, money talks. And finally, the FBI on Thursday arrested Ghislaine Maxwell, longtime confidant of sex offender Jeffrey Epstein, on allegations that she helped her then-boyfriend recruit underage girls who were subjected to sexual abuse. Ah, it's about time. Hopefully just some justice can be served. All right, quick time out and back on the other side with Congressman Eric Swalwell, who's got a new book out called Endgame. I'm Nicole Sandler, your guest host today on the broadcast.
All the California, California, coming home.
I'm Nicole Sandler, your guest host today on the broadcast. Let's head out to California. Eric Swalwell is a congressman from California. We've gotten to know him from his numerous appearances on television and his wonderful questioning during the impeachment inquiry. And now he's got a new book out. It's called Endgame. Congressman Swalwell, thank you so much for being here today.
Of course. Thank you so much, Nicole, for having me on.
Oh, it's my pleasure. So the book just was released. You're in very crowded company, but good company.
Nicole, you're right. It's right around the time that John Bolton's The Room Where It Happened book comes out. But I was actually in the room where it happened, in the room where holding the president accountable was on the House of Representatives side, where we heard from courageous witnesses like Marie Ivanovich and Lieutenant Colonel Vindman and Fiona Hill. And it's really a testament to their courage. It's a condemnation of the cowardice I saw from too many Republicans, and also a call to action that we now have to impeach and remove the president at the ballot box, because that's the only remedy for frankly, this national nightmare that we've been living for the last 4 years.
Well, we absolutely do. And I was one of the people who was not really happy that you were not chosen to be one of the impeachment managers, because, frankly, during the inquiry, you did a really great job of questioning. I was very impressed. I thought you were a shoo-in. Were you surprised? I mean, I'm guessing you threw your hat in the ring if that's how it worked.
I wanted to. Yeah. And I talked about that in the book. I wanted to do it. I wanted to, frankly, do whatever I could to help the team. And one of the parts that the public probably didn't see was just the solidarity and the unity among the teams, both the Intelligence Committee and Judiciary Committee. And Val Demings and I were the two that were on both. And you really bond when you're going through something like this. But, as disappointed as I was when it was announced, I realized it wasn't about me. This was about the president of the United States needing to be removed. It was a decision for the Speaker of the House to make, and she alone. And the team that she sent over there was phenomenal. And they did the best job they could. And frankly, only one Republican, Mitt Romney, had the courage to follow the evidence and not put their own careers above our national security.
Now, were you surprised about that? Did you expect anything different? Or did you think that any Republicans would come around and do the right thing?
No, I believe the case that we put forward should have moved them to do that. But we also were holding out hope that, perhaps some of the witnesses who were reluctant to come forward when we put our case on, maybe once it made it to the Senate, would come forward. People like John Bolton or Mick Mulvaney. And they didn't. And it was because the Senate essentially gave them an alibi by never subpoenaing them. And so, no, I'm not surprised. And, in the book, Nicole, I laid out that I had a lot of friends when I first went to Congress in 2012 on the Republican side, and I saw this transition from being able to work with them, not necessarily on every issue, but once Donald Trump came into power, first phase was denial. They were in denial about the fact that he actually won. They would privately express concern about his embracing of Russia. But they would also express fear that if he tweets at them, as one of them said, he wins. And then in 2018, once we won the House and beat 41 of them to flip the House, you saw that they were in full-on enabling mode. And that's what we saw. They took out the shovels. They helped them bury the evidence as much as they could. And that's why I'm convinced that we need a reckoning now in November. Otherwise, It's going to get worse.
Without a doubt. Now, Congressman Swalwell, you mentioned, of course, John Bolton again, and the fact that he didn't testify. I mean, I'm out here screaming. I understand. I want to read the book. The revelations we've seen so far are stunning. You know, kind of what I thought we'd see. But I don't want to put any money in his pocket. This is a man who didn't stand up as an American citizen and do the right thing. He saw all this stuff and was in the room when it was happening and decided, well, I'm going to hold off until I can collect a paycheck from a book instead of testifying before Congress when he was asked to do so during the inquiry and then again during the impeachment trial. Why do we have no recourse when it comes to having a public servant testify before Congress?
Because the president and his team have defied the congressional subpoena power. And they think that if they don't show up, they don't have to answer for what they've done. And so we're now going through the courts to see if Congress does indeed have a subpoena power. That's why this tax returns case is so important. And we expect a Supreme Court decision on that as early as Monday. But yeah. Going back to John Bolton, remember, we subpoenaed him in the House and then he said, I'll see you in court. And we felt the urgency to act that we weren't going to wait months on end to see him in court while the president was trying to rig an upcoming election. And then when it went to the Senate and he said, I have information, well, Chairman Schiff asked him to at least submit an affidavit and he wouldn't do that. So now, you know, him showing up with this book and these disturbing revelations, it's like a firefighter showing up with his fire truck and his fire hose. But the building is now in rubble and ashes. It's
yeah,
like, great.
Right.
Where were you when we really needed you?
Exactly.
But nothing is surprising as far as what he's alleged.
No,
it
no,
fits
no.
The pattern of a president who would welcome interference, put his yep. own interests above the country's. And again, I think it just has to move people now to the ballot box.
Now, would you consider subpoenaing him now, even though what's the point? We need to now just get him out of office. But is that something maybe down the road that you would consider doing? Because, look, even if we do hopefully get Donald Trump out of the White House, we need to hold him accountable for what he's inflicted on this nation for the last 4 years and beyond.
Yeah, we can't take the ankle monitor off this president until January 20. 2021. So I do believe we have to, you know, vigorously use our oversight power. And I know Chairman Schiff is considering all of the options available to us to make sure that we do that, including whether or not we would subpoena John Bolton. But I'll leave that to the chairman. I think he's very wisely and effectively led us for these past 2 years.
Right. So Congressman Eric Swalwell is with us. You have two Twitter accounts. You have Eric
yes.
Swalwell and Rep Swalwell. I know you follow me at Eric Swalwell. Was it one so that you could do your personal business on one and do the business of Congress on the other?
No, we're under really strict rules in the House. So anything that we do for official business with taxpayer dollars to communicate constituent resources or what we're doing in the House, that has to be under at Rep Swalwell. And then at Eric Swalwell is a personal account. So it reflects, you know, understandably the rules that make sure that taxpayer dollars aren't abused.
Well, thank you for that, because there's such a blurring of those lines, especially with this administration. I mean, Trump goes on these trips, like, for instance, the thing in Tulsa. It is a campaign rally, and yet he uses official resources and I believe pays a lot of uses taxpayer dollars to do these things. I realize that trying to perform oversight on a president such as this has got to be really difficult. With Trump, it's like they throw all this against the wall and see what sticks. And there's no way, even with a dedicated, diligent press and Congress trying to perform oversight, that you can confront each one of these things that he throws against the wall. It's so much on any given day. There's multiple things. Trying to cover it all and stay on top of what he's done is exhausting. And for you guys, there's no way
it
you can
exhausting.
Deal with all of it. So how do you pick and choose what you try to call him out on? Or is how frustrating is all this?
That's a great question, because he does not believe in or follow the rule of law. As I said, they defy subpoenas. And in the book, I laid out that during the Russia investigation, for example, that started when the Republicans were in the majority in the House, we would bring in Obama administration officials, former officials, and every single one of them honored their subpoena, did not put any qualifications or limitations on their testimony. And then when the Trump witnesses would come in, whether it was Jared Kushner, Hope Hicks, Don Jr., they would refuse to testify anytime we got close, you know, to what the president was doing with Russia. They would just say, I refuse to answer. I refuse to answer. The number of times I heard that during their interview. So they believe they're above the law. And the only way to, you know, really enforce these subpoenas is to win in the courts. And if we're not going to win in the courts, we need to win, certainly need to win at the ballot box, and then have in 2021, you know, a reshaping of the courts that that believes congressional subpoenas matter, that believes in the independent prosecutions from the Department of Justice, because this president has just taken a wrecking ball to so many of the institutions that we've always counted on.
Right. You know, the hypocrisy is not surprising at this point. We come to expect it from the Republicans. But the fact that they're now throwing out subpoenas to investigate, as Donald Trump calls it, the oranges of the Russia investigation is astounding. So they're okay with those subpoenas. You just can't subpoena anyone if they're a Republican. The same way Donald Trump says criticism of anybody is fine as long as they're not Republicans. If you criticize a Republican, according to Trump, you're a traitor and you're guilty of treason. I mean, I get that he's uneducated and doesn't understand how government works. But this is your fourth term in Congress, right? And so obviously you were there under Obama, which at least was a functional administration. How much of a difference is there between the way the Obama administration operated and the way the Trump administration does things for you as a member of Congress?
You know, I remember during, I believe it was 2017, there was a hurricane that had just before Maria, I believe it was Irma, it had wiped out Saint Martin,
yes,
which is a split between the Netherlands and the French. And there were about 10,000 U.S. Citizens vacationing there. And I was working, you know, with the State Department at that time to try and, you know, figure out how we could get U.S. citizens out of there, off the island, because there was no power and it was really starting to get chaotic. And I realized early on, just administratively, that no one could sign off on any of the efforts that were being channeled through me of people who were offering private planes to go in there and pick up as many U.S. citizens as possible, trying to come up with options to, you know, marshal resources to get citizens off the island. And anytime we would start to make progress, I was told, well, we have to run this even farther up the chain because we only have acting assistant secretaries or deputy secretaries. And that was intentional. It wasn't that the Senate hadn't moved to confirm the president has a Republican majority in the Senate. It's just that he doesn't believe in government. So put aside the corruption and, as you said, being uneducated, unethical. He just doesn't believe in government helping people. And so he hasn't filled the positions that can help people in a time of crisis, like during those hurricanes, as we're seeing right now during the pandemic, where they shelved the pandemic playbook. And so he just doesn't believe in government. And we're all paying the price because of it. And that's not what we saw with the Obama administration.
Right. As much as, look, I disagreed with Obama on a lot of what he did. I'm further to the left. I wanted to see a more progressive administration. And frankly, what he ran on, and that's not what we got. But oh, my goodness, just knowing how they functioned as an operational government and seeing what we're dealing with now is just incredible to me.
And I have another example for you, Nicole. During those Russia interviews that the Republicans led, and sorry, I'm running a startup preschool here.
You can hear awesome. That's wonderful. I'm all for kids and dogs making noise in the background. That's fine. Oh, so, hey, sweetie. Oh, she's
this
adorable.
Is Cricket.
Cricket? Oh, she's
Cricket.
Cute.
Yep.
Hi, Cricket.
Thank you. So it was interesting. There was not, the scheduling of witnesses was not always purposeful or intentional. It was really just around availability of witnesses. So one day you would have someone like Susan Rice or other senior officials testifying before the committee, and they were professional, knowledgeable, dignified. And then the next day you would have Roger Stone and you would have, you know, just all these different clowns and characters that were on the Trump team. And it was, for me, the best contrast of, you know, where we were. People who, again, cared about government, cared about helping people, again, put the politics aside. They've just had experience and knowledge and ethics. And then you had this, you know, freakish clown show that had come into Washington on the Trump train. Mm-hmm. And it just, that was very, you know, jarring to see that.
Now,
just
the whole thing. Now, you know, you're also a lawyer, and that was very apparent during your questioning. And you sit on both the Intelligence and the Judiciary Committees, two really plum assignments. And I'm glad you're there because you're very effective in there. But as an attorney, seeing what Bill Barr is doing to the Justice Department, does it make your head explode? I mean, me as just a layman, civilian, I couldn't deal with I call it opposite world, where nothing makes sense. In is out, up is down, left is, well, not right, but you know what I'm saying? It just, and he is just undermining the rule of law on every front. How do you deal with something like that, especially as an attorney and a member of Congress?
So I come from an office in Oakland, California. It's the Alameda County District Attorney's Office. And Kamala Harris was a prosecutor in that office. But most notably, Earl Warren was a prosecutor in that office. And he came in and cleaned up a corrupt system that during Prohibition, you know, was enabling kind of the underworld of crime in Oakland. And he cleaned it up. And that was reflected in the Miranda decision and some of the other decisions that he ruled on to make sure defendants had more rights. And so the mantra in our office, and I talk about this in the book, is we do justice. And so I'm pretty, I would say, old school when it comes to the mixture of politics and prosecutions. I really think prosecutors have to be independent of politics. And I cringe when either a Republican or a Democrat tries to weigh in and tell prosecutors, you know, what they should do with the case. I think it's okay to say something's right or wrong, but to try and use political influence to tell a, you know, whether it's the attorney general or anyone else, what type of charges they should bring. I think we have to let the evidence guide what we do and nothing else. And with Bill Barr, it's just enabling Donald Trump's, you know, political preferences.
Yeah.
And I hope the next person who leads that office is a true prosecutor that, you know, thinks about equal justice under law with little regard at all.
I hope so, because Eric Swalwell is our guest. I'm reading your book, Endgame. I apologize. I'm not as far enough along in it as
I
hoped. But I just got.
Oh,
sure. And it's fascinating. And especially since we lived through this, you really are the book. It goes through what we lived through last year with the from the impeachment inquiry through the impeachment through the Mueller report. And I just earlier today read the section on the day of Mueller's testimony and how, you know, the media went with, well, it wasn't the bombshell we were hoping for. So, you know, impeachment's over. And you lived through, I mean, we put so much hope into Mueller finally just exposing this administration for what they are. And then Bill Barr, so it's released, and Bill Barr puts out this 4-page alternate universe explanation of what's in it that had no bearing on reality. Again, I could sense your frustration because all the work you guys did all that whole time leading up to the report, and then they lie about everything. They lie with such impunity. You don't expect that from the attorney general, even if he is Donald Trump's attorney general.
And Nicole, it felt like, again, we had both hands behind our back because all we were saying was let Mueller do his job.
Right.
You know, we were not, you know, trying to influence where the prosecution went. We were just saying, let it follow the evidence. And then, as you pointed out, Bill Barr immediately comes out and mischaracterizes what Mueller had said, to the point where Mueller had to send a letter, if you remember,
mm-hmm.
calling out Barr for mischaracterizing what he had found. And then, yeah, the media, I think, did want a Broadway show. And I talk about an exchange I have with a pretty well-known television anchor who texted me during the hearing and said, I think you guys are losing if you're hoping Mueller's going to save you. And I wrote back to this individual and I said, well, he's not trying to win. He's trying to lay out evidence of one of the most complex criminal cases ever investigated in our country. And so if you listen to what he said, or if you read the report, it's clear the president welcomed what Russia was doing. No prior Congress had ever envisioned writing a law to say you couldn't do what he did. We certainly have now. But he also committed 10 different crimes of obstruction of justice that by his own Department of Justice's standards, he can't be prosecuted for. Right. So what I point out in the book, Nicole, is that after the Mueller report, although the press panned it, there was a cascade of members who got on board with impeachment because they were so concerned about what they had heard and read.
Right. Right. Well, Democrats, of course. And they should have been. And Democrats are the only ones who read the report. Republicans didn't. Such partisanship when it comes to oversight, and it shouldn't be there. But, I hate to keep bringing up John Bolton, but I don't agree with anything he says, except one thing that I heard that he says in his book that I do agree with. And I did when it started, when Nancy Pelosi introduced the articles of impeachment, and there were only those four. When there was so much shit thrown against the wall that there were hundreds of things you could have chosen from, my thought was give them a lot so that some Republicans can actually say, okay, well, I'm not going to go along with these, but this one, you know, give them a way to say no to it. But so do you think that was a mistake to only introduce those four articles of impeachment and not throw the book at him and really take him to task for everything he's done?
And I talk a lot about that in the book. So I don't think it was a mistake. It was intensely debated because there was a camp of, ring him up for everything he's on the hook for. And the other camp, and I think this is where I agreed with the speaker in the sense that we had to cut through to the American people and keep it as simple as possible. And so the team of Lawrence Tribe and some of the outside folks, who were advising us on this, they really believe that when you look at the founder's intent and the Federalist Papers, abuse of power is the greatest crime a public official could commit, not just in the United States, but they went farther back to in the British system when we were a colony. And so the concept of a person using their office, to essentially commit bribery, that is the highest crime and misdemeanor that you could commit because it's a crime against the Constitution. And so we wanted to keep that, very, clear and to the point. And then the second article, of course, was obstruction of Congress for the just blanket refusal to cooperate with any of our investigations. But it was, Nicole, intensely debated. And I think just recognizing the urgency to act and the need to make sure the public understood what we were doing, we landed on two articles.
So, okay. So
he's good for probably 100, right? There's no disputing that.
I gotcha. And he is, and he should be brought up on charges. Do you believe that if Donald, this is a two-part question, if he loses, which he should, that he will leave voluntarily? And once we get him out of office, do you believe that he will be brought up on charges and held accountable for everything he's done?
I think he faces criminal exposure. Yes, I believe you have the obstruction of justice issue. God knows how prosecutors are going to view what he did with President Zelensky in Ukraine. I remember Bill Barr, they said in like a couple of days, they looked at that and then said that there's no crime there. That doesn't mean future prosecutors cannot look at, welcoming foreign interference or a contribution from a foreign government. There's this new allegation from John Bolton, which will have to be investigated with
China,
not only the Chinese, but also Turkey.
Right.
The favors he was asking, the favors that Erdogan was asking of and what he was doing. And then, of course, he is still individual one. So I think he faces vast criminal exposure. But to the more immediate question, do I believe he will leave office? No. But one thing I know about Donald Trump is that he is a coward. And this is what we saw with the impeachment investigation. Only once we launched it did he back down. Only once we launched a congressional investigation did he back down and actually give Ukraine the money that had already been voted on that he had signed into law. So I believe that's a call to action for us to overwhelm the ballot box, not even make it close, so that it's easy if some young military officer or Secret Service agent gets the order that you have to go tell him you're no longer the resident of this house, you got to go. But if it's close, that's where you can envision him summoning these, you know, supporters gangs of his who have stormed state capitals in Wisconsin and Kentucky and Michigan, you know, in their camouflage and
their guns,
carrying their AR-15s. Yep. You can see him trying to play into that confusion. But if it's not even close and it's a blowout, I think that's where he just backs down. And
well, he's got to. And I don't know. I don't know about you, but I'm a bit heartened by the recent members of the military, former members of the administration, who have come out in recent days and said, you know what? This is wrong. He's a bad guy, from Mattis to Kelly to, you know, that makes me think, all right, the military is not going to protect this guy. They're going to protect the country. And I have to hope that that's the case.
And Nicole, when you saw him make that walk from the Rose Garden to the church right outside Lafayette Square with his massive entourage, you just have to think that he believes those are the people, the ones that used chemical weapons, you know, on peaceful protesters, the ones that cleared the way with him and walked as an entourage. He has to believe that those are the people that will protect him. And that's why it's all the more important that senior military officials, former officials, speak up and signal to current military officials that we have a rule of law.
Yes.
We have a peaceful transition of power, and they may need to be called upon because we don't know what this president is going to do.
Without a doubt. There's so many more questions I have for you, and we're getting close to the end of the hour. So we'll do a little bit of a lightning round. What did you learn from your run for president?
It's very hard. But, you know, I would say I learned a lot about the country in the sense that people in South Carolina, in Iowa, and New Hampshire take their role of vetting a president so seriously.
Oh, yeah.
It's like a second job. And that was really heartening to see. And it gave me a lot of respect for anyone who's ever run, and especially anyone who's won, because of the vetting that you go through, the excruciating and, painstaking days. But I also learned it's a real test of confidence. And, I was ready for the long physical days and hours of the campaign trail. But I mean, every single day you wake up and it's a test of, you know, mental confidence. And so when I think about, you know, Joe Biden, I think this is his third or fourth time, you know, running. Like he's a tested candidate, and he's been a vice president.
That's one way to look at it.
Yeah. But he's carrying himself with the confidence that you need. And you need to have confidence on the trail. And I think that was something that, just being candid with you, that was harder for me to, you know, get my sea legs throughout the race. I loved it. I don't regret doing it. Okay. I would have regretted had I not run. And on the issue of gun violence, I really believe, we elevated that issue. And on my first debate night, I was able to get a number of candidates to commit to assault weapons ban and buyback, which I think is the only way to get those weapons of war.
That's awesome. And thank you. I live in Coral Springs, Florida. We're right next door to Parkland. Yeah. So, we've all been touched by gun violence, and it's criminal that we still don't have an assault weapons ban. So thank you for that. You think you'll run again?
I don't think so.
No?
I would have regretted had I not run. And the best advice I give to Nicole, to my interns who ask what should they do if they want to run for office, I think it's the best advice. The advice I give them is don't run for an office, run on issues. So seek out the issues you care about in the community and you'll find the office. But if you just say, I want to be in this office, so I'm going to run for this and this and this and climb my way up, I think people will see through that. I also think it never plays out the way you expect. And you could also be demoralized by losing on one of those, steps that you don't serve at all. And so I'll continue to care about ending gun violence, climate, student loan debt, and I think I'll find the best way to serve. That's the advice I give my interns, and it's the advice I follow myself.
Gotcha. And one last question. During the debates, you did make a point of the generational aspect of it, and maybe it's time to bring in a new generation of leaders. Once we get past this election, is it time for a change in leadership in both the House and the Senate?
Well, thank God we have Speaker Pelosi there right now, right?
I
think there is an exception to every rule, and she's the exception to every rule. Thank God she's there. But what I have played a part in, and I lay this out in the book, is leading an effort called Future Forum. And in the last election, 29 members in their 40s and under were elected. They're the most diverse group of candidates that ran in every way. And my hope is that on the issues of student loan debt, climate, and gun violence, that they will lead the way. And Vice President Biden called me when I dropped out, Nicole, and he told me, you mentioned passing the torch, and he said, I hear you. And if I'm elected president, I promise to enable the next generation. And
awesome.
I'll take him at his word.
Congressman Eric Swalwell, the book is Endgame. Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to meet you.
Thank you.
I hope we can do it again
sometime.
Thank
you for all you're doing to be a voice of reason.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that. Some kind words from Congressman Eric Swalwell at the end there. In just a moment, a few closing words as we ponder the meaning of Independence Day. I'm Nicole Sandler, your guest host today on the broadcast. It's Nicole Sandler, back again, guest hosting the broadcast so Brad and Desi can enjoy a 4th of July holiday, long extended weekend. I live in Florida, so I don't go anywhere because we have had 10,000 new cases or thereabouts every day for the last few days. This is one of the worst hotspots in the nation. So as a lung cancer survivor with operating on a lung and a quarter, I don't leave the house. And when I do, it's with a mask and gloves on. So I think we're in this for the long haul. Anyway, I'm celebrating my 4th of July at home, watching Hamilton streaming on Disney Plus. Yeah, for $7, we'll sign up for a month so we can watch Hamilton in the comfort of our own home. But I was thinking a lot about, you know, this 4th of July holiday. The president is making a mockery of everything by having another super spreader event. This one at Mount Rushmore? Really? Mount Rushmore? Let me share with you. Well, we're on radio, so I can only give you the audio version. But the Lincoln Project has another ad. Well, they have an ad for every occasion. And this time, the ad is in honor of Mount Rushmore. And what they did was they assembled a series of quotes from the four presidents who are chiseled into the mountain there. And then a message for the current president, who will never have a space among those on Mount Rushmore. Here's the Lincoln Project ad.
The alternate domination of one faction over another is itself a frightful despotism. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. America will never be destroyed from the outside. If we falter, it will be because we destroyed ourselves. It is of little use for us to pay lip loyalty to the mighty men of the past unless we sincerely endeavor to apply the problems of the present precisely the qualities which in other crises enabled the men of that day to meet those crises. Four of America's greatest presidents are carved into the living rock of South Dakota's Black Hills. They are a memorial to those who served with honor, led with courage, and took this great nation into the future. Their words, deeds, and legacies will survive time immemorial. America's worst president will neither be remembered nor revered. The Lincoln Project is responsible for the content of this advertising.
And the quote they showed next to Donald Trump's picture was, "I take no responsibility." Boom. But you know, this year, Independence Day stands for the same thing, but I think many of us have a different part of American history on our minds. We are concerned about how a good portion of our population has been treated through the years. Some people are still struggling with the words Black Lives Matter. In fact, I was there a few years ago. If you go back through the archives of my show, you'll hear a spirited conversation. Not that I'm asking you to do it, because it wasn't one of my proudest moments. But you can find a spirited conversation between me and a Black woman about the subject of white privilege. And I'll tell you, 5-6 years ago, I didn't get it because I was going through a rough time. Still am. But I wasn't hearing what she was saying. I've done a lot of soul searching since then, and I fully understand it now. And I want to share with you something that popped up on my Facebook feed a few days ago that I've shared, and it is one of the best explanations of what Black Lives Matter is all about, an explanation maybe for white people who still don't quite get it. So here's how this goes. And I wish I knew who wrote this so I could thank them, because it's that good. Anyway, this anonymous person wrote, "In the simplest terms, 400 years ago, white people brought Black people over here and enslaved them and sold them and treated them as less than human. For 250 years, while white men built the country and created its laws and its systems of government, while 10, 15 generations of white families got to grow and flourish and make choices that could make their lives better. And then 150 years ago, white people, quote, freed Black people from slavery. But then angry white people created laws that made it impossible for them to vote or to own land or to have the same rights as white people, and even erected monuments glorifying people who actively had fought to keep them enslaved. All while another 5-10 generations of white families got to grow and accumulate wealth and gain land and get an education. And then 60 years ago, we made it, quote, legal for Black people to vote and to be, quote, free from discrimination. But angry white people still fought to keep schools segregated and closed off neighborhoods to white people only, and made it harder for Black people to get bank loans or get quality education or health care or to gasp, marry a white person. All while another 2-3 generations of white families got to grow and pass their wealth down to their children and their children's children. And then we entered an age where we had the technology to make public the things that were already happening in private. The beatings, the stop and frisk laws, the unequal distribution of justice, the police brutality. Police began in America as slave patrols designed to catch runaway slaves. And only now, after 400 plus years and 20 plus generations of a white head start, are we starting to truly have a dialogue about what it means to be Black. White privilege doesn't mean you haven't suffered or fought or worked hard. It doesn't mean white people are responsible for the sins of our ancestors. It doesn't mean you can't be proud of who you are. But it does mean that we need to acknowledge that the system our ancestors created is built for white people. It does mean that we aren't disadvantaged because of the color of our skin. And it does mean that we owe it to our neighbors of all colors to acknowledge that and work to make our world more equitable. Black Lives Matter. Again, I don't know who wrote it, but those words ring so true. And if they help one person understand what this is about, another white person to understand what white privilege is about, then I hope you'll share it. The other night, I'm not a sports fan, but my husband is a big fan of a show on HBO called Real Sports with Brian Gumbel. You remember Brian Gumbel, used to host the Today Show a lifetime ago. Well, he's in his 70s now, still looks good. And he did a story in this last episode about a young man who was shot by police. It was in a suburb of Houston, I believe. His father had been a pro baseball player, and they lived in this community called Bel Air in Texas for decades. Well, their son, who was, I think, 23 years old at the time, was out on his way, came home, drove into the driveway, followed by a police car. And to make a long story short, the cop thought he was a suspect who had stolen a car, because he's Black, you know, and shot him. as his parents, who had heard the commotion and came outside from the house, this was about 2 a.m, in their pajamas. And they were treated like criminals and manhandled and thrown in the back of the police cars while their son was lying on the driveway bleeding out. Well, thankfully, the son survived, but his life was changed. So Brian Gumbel told this story, just one of many young black men, unarmed young black men, who were shot by police in a show of force, in a show of power. But then Brian Gumbel ended the show with a word to the camera, and it was about the black tax. And I want to share that with you right now.
Finally tonight, as we close out this Real Sports edition devoted in great part to racial injustice, a few personal words seem fitting about what some friends and I often refer to as the black tax. It's not an IRS thing. It's the added burden that comes with being black in America. And it's routinely paid, no matter how much education you have, how much money you make, or how much success you've earned. The black tax is about more than just the added stares, whispers, and suspicions when you're out and about. It's about the many instances of disrespect and incivility your color seems to engender, and being expected to somehow always restrain yourself, lest you not be what white Americans are never asked to be, a credit to your race. It's about living a life that included your father having to leave home to earn his law degree, even though he was an honor student and a decorated war veteran. It's about your son getting arrested for doing nothing more than walking while black. And it's about having to be more concerned than your white friends and associates for the safety of your grandkids. It's about the day in and day out fatigue of trying to explain the obvious to the clueless. It's about being asked to overlook blue failings and white failings so they can be conveniently viewed as black issues. It's about being asked by so many what they should do or say about race when the easy answer lies in the privacy of each person's heart. It's the black tax. It's paid daily by me and every person of color in this country, and frankly, it is exhausting. I've been paying the black tax in America for almost 72 years now, long enough that I shouldn't have to ask others to simply accept one very basic reality, that our black lives matter. Thank you for being with us. Stay safe. Good night.
And there you have it, a Brian Gumbel speaking words of truth and words that people who look like me may not realize. So this year on the 4th of July, I think it's important for us to listen to those other voices in this country who may not look like us, but are still Americans as we are. And we need to come together, I really think, to save what's left of this nation. And hopefully we can start turning things around again come November, and then again in January when we get the orange menace out of the Oval Office. We don't usually play music on the broadcast, but I'm going to leave you with a song today. With Broadway dark through at least the end of the year, I'm going to play for you a song that's from a Broadway show. Now, this show closed after a limited run on Broadway a couple of years ago, and it's Bruce Springsteen. And I bring it up today because I noticed something on Twitter a few hours ago, and it was somebody, some right-wing politician who I can't even remember who it was, but one of them finally got the message of what the lyrics of Bruce Springsteen's Born in the USA is about. It is not, as Ronald Reagan tried to appropriate it back in 1984, a song saying, rah, rah, my country is great. It's a song about what's wrong with this country. And the rendition that Bruce Springsteen performed on Broadway, I think, is more true to the message than the original version that was found in the album by the same name. So from Bruce Springsteen on Broadway, I will leave you with Born in the USA. And wish us all a very happy 4th of July, a happy Independence Day, along with my hopes and wishes for a much more democratic America. And let's hope we can make it through November 3rd and beyond. We'll be right back.
born down in a dead man's town. The first kick I took was when I hit the ground. You end up like a dog that's been beat too much till you spend half your life just covering I was born in the USA. Born in the USA. I got in a little hometown jam. So they put a rifle in my hands. Sent me off to a foreign land. To go and kill the yellow man. I was born in the USA. Born in the USA. Come back home with a refinery. Iron Man says, son, if it was up to me. Went down to see my VA man. He said, son, don't you understand? No. I had a brother at Quezon fighting off the Viet Cong. They're still there. He's all gone, gone. He had a woman he loved in Saigon. I got a picture of him in her arms. In her arms. Down the shadow of the penitentiary. Out by the gas fires of the refineries. I'm 40 years burning down the road, 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 the road. I've got nowhere to run. I've got nowhere to go. I'm a long gone daddy in the USA. I'm a cool, cool rockin' daddy in the USA.
Thanks for listening. I'm your guest host, Nicole Sampler. Brad and Desi will be back next time for the Bradcast. Happy 4th of July and good luck, world.